Cairo, Seattle.
It's time to get schooled with a professor, John Clayton.
Welcome to Schooled with a Professor, and today we're going to give you a little bit of a history lesson and kind of take you through some things that you never have really thought of before, because one of the things that is, you know, it touches the area of University of Washington, it touches the National Football League, and certainly it touches a lot of different things is, American Samoa. Because there's been so many great football players that have come over, affected things both on college football, in the NFL, and really done such a great job to try to do it. And a guy who just did a book on it, traveled there, Rob Ruck, who writes the book, Tropics of Football. And, of course, what's great about this, it kind of gives you the kind of the history of American Samoa, how it's developed as far as the football, the sports, and of course there's been such great players, Marcus Mariota, I mean, you got Troy Polamalu, all these different players. And so, Rob, what got you to get into this book? Because again, you kind of get the whole history of all this.
John, delighted to have a chance to talk with you. I'm always fascinated with athletic excellence, and growing up in Pittsburgh, I've seen a lot of that over the years. But what really interests me the most are the small little cultures that produce disproportionate numbers of talented athletes. And I want to know why. And that led me about 7 years ago to get on a plane and spend the next 24 hours getting to Pongo Pongo to try to begin figuring that out. And that's what Tropic of Football is about. The story that Samoans have told about themselves to the world through sport, especially football, and for people from independent Samoa rugby, what it means to them and what cost they've paid to become so visible in the American game.
So take us through the first history of when football became somewhat involved with Samoans and how that kind of evolved, and just go to the beginning roots of it.
Sure. The islands that constitute the territory of American Samoa are tiny little volcanic uplifts in the South Pacific, about a six-hour flight from Honolulu. The first Samoans who started to play football were not from the territory, but from Hawaii, the result of some early 20th century migrations, one to the north shore of Oahu, where Samoans came to help build the first Mormon temple outside the mainland of the United States. A later migration occurred after World War II, when the U.S. shut down a naval base in Samoa and gave passage to all the Samoans who were in the military or worked for it and their families, and that led to a number of Samoan-American communities around Pearl Harbor, Long Beach, California, Oceanside, California, Fort Lewis. And the sons of that migration in the 60s and 70s became what's known as the Polynesian Pipeline. The game, though, didn't get to the territory till the late 60s, when the islands were viewed as an embarrassment during the Cold War, particularly after Reader's Digest did a cover story calling the territory America's shame in the South Pacific. And we responded under Kennedy, trying to build up the island, creating high schools for all the kids, and that led to high school football. And since then, the game has just tapped into Samoan culture, into what's called Fa'a Samoa, the way of Samoa, which is a very disciplined culture, and that discipline is amplified by the high religiosity of the culture and the fact that Samoans are not only the most overly represented group in American football, but in the American military.
Interesting. Now, you said that before World War II, it kind of got into a little bit into the culture. I mean, how far back does that go before World War II?
Well, these islands only become a U.S. territory in the early 1900s. And then the United States just forgot about them because they found a better way to get to the China market. And they no longer needed Pongo Pongo as a fueling station, a coal station. So they benefited in many ways from American neglect, and the lifestyle remained what it had been for several thousand years, where people lived off the land and what they took from the ocean. And that led to an extremely fit population. Now, all of that's going to change with World War II, when there are going to be more Marines and sailors stationed there than Samoans, and Samoans become fierce American patriots, that's going to change the diet and the lifestyle. And no longer are people living a subsistence agriculture and fishing economy, but they're wage laborers. And that's going to change things in some ways for the worse, but it draws them into the orbit of America. And football becomes a way for a lot of kids growing up in the island to feel that they're part of America.
So now, you said back in the 60s, it was kind of almost a little bit of a disgrace. How bad was it back then?
Well, the Reader's Digest writer who was there looked at outhouses that were built on docks that basically dropped feces into Pongo Pongo Bay, government buildings eroding on their foundations, an island that got 200 inches of rain a year without a drinkable water supply, classrooms that accommodated only a fraction of the kids. It was pretty bad. And that changed rather quickly.
So then,
when the U.S. got interested.
So then it gets into the high schools, and I guess, as you mentioned, the second generation people start getting involved in it. But is there one, two, or three people that really started to get football into the minds over there?
You know, I think the guy who does that is Jesse Sapalu. He's not mm-hmm. the first Samoan in the NFL, but he's somebody who just embodies, I think, all that's great about Samoan culture. Jesse was born in independent Samoa. Family moved to California and then Hawaii. He plays at Farrington High School with Al, Pete, and Nico Nonga, and another Samoan, who all then go to the University of Hawaii when Dick Tomey is rebuilding that program. And then Sapalu helps San Francisco 49ers win four Super Bowls, despite the fact that he's dealing with some heart issues that cause open-heart surgery. Later on, Jesse is asked to assume a chiefly title by the King of Samoa. And he not only did, but he took that position very seriously. And his success, but also his persona, I think, defined Samoan football for a decade or two. Obviously, the two men that continue to do that and did that at the highest level were Junior Seau and Troy Polamalu. Now, all three of those guys are retired, but as you noted, with Marcus Mariota and Juju Smith-Schuster and Tua Tagovailoa, there's another generation or two of Samoans who are making the scene, and more of these kids coming through high schools, colleges, and into the NFL.
And, of course, I know, again, with the University of Washington and a lot of the Pac-12 schools, you know, they have benefited from that. How intense was the football product that was out there in the field? And how did, as Jesse and others started to really popularize it, how big did it get?
Well, you know, I think Samoan football develops in two different ways. One are the players like Troy and Junior and Jesse who come up through high schools in Hawaii and California and Oregon. There they're exposed to a pretty solid football infrastructure, great coaching, and develop their skills appropriately and at an all-American level. The kids in the islands, when they started to have football in the late 60s and 70s, the coaches were learning how to coach from reading a book about football because they had never played themselves. They still, in the territory, lack decent fields. These guys play on fields that are furrowed with pools of water, stubbled with golf ball-sized chunks of volcanic rock. They hardly have weight rooms to speak of. Their helmets would not be used at any high school in the United States because they no longer meet safety standards, but they go at it with a warrior spirit. Some of these schools begin practicing in January and February, have daily four-hour scrimmages throughout the summer, and don't finish their season until the end of November. The amount of hitting they do is far in excess of what kids in the U.S. do. Now, when those kids come to the United States, they face a number of obstacles. They still speak more Samoan than English. They are growing up in village culture where the discipline is quick and strict, and they're part of a culture in which respect for older people, whether it's your teacher, your parent, your auntie, or your coach, are off the charts. And now they've got to make that cultural adjustment without the kind of support and stability they've been accustomed to, which is why a lot of these kids don't last their first year in U.S. colleges. But those that do often end up playing at a pretty high level.
From your research in that, kind of take us through what a typical high school or whatever would have, say from the time of Jesse Sapolo when he started to popularize it around Samoa to you know, now 1990 when, mid 1980s when Junior Seau was going through college and then getting into the NFL. How did it kind of grow from the Sapolo age to the Seau age?
You know, I think that folks like Jesse Sapolo, Jack Thompson, and other Samoans caught the attention of college coaches and recruiters, and they started gravitating to places like Farrington High School, to Kahuku High School in Oahu, to Oceanside and El Camino in Oceanside, California, to Long Beach Poly, and recruiting these guys because they were not only very physical, very disciplined, and very committed players, they also provide something that coaches love, which is that they're the emotional centerpiece of locker rooms. And any coach anywhere, including Nick Saban, who pulls Tua Tagovailoa from St. Louis, the St. Louis school in Honolulu, where Marcus Mariota went, are finding these kids. Now, it took a much longer period of time for them to start showing up in American Samoa. In the 70s, these guys often played without shoes. They traded helmets. One guy would flip his helmet to somebody else when he left the field. They even shared mouth guards. Gradually, things have gotten better. And that has a lot to do with players who have gone back and given back to the island, like Troy Polamalu, whose foundation that he and his wife Theodora have run, have held, I think, four or five football and volleyball camps on the island, which have expanded to include building computer centers and dealing with public health, which frankly is a bit of a disaster. With coaches like June Jones, who, since coaching a lot of Polynesian kids at the University of Hawaii and SMU, has made a point to go back. So it's gotten a lot better, but there's still, they just don't have the money to do what needs to be done. And, you know, it's kind of an interesting thing. I look at Samoans as what I would call a microculture of sporting excellence, producing a disproportionate number of talented athletes. But in those microcultures, and whether it's Samoans or Dominicans in baseball or African Americans in U.S. basketball and the like, while they're at one end of the spectrum of fitness and health, the larger public health averages for their communities are on the other end. And American Samoa, Samoans in general, along with Tongans, have the worst incidence of diabetes and obesity on the globe. And there's much that needs to be done, and there's not a whole lot of resources to do it.
So how much better is it now in the high school level than, say, it was 15 years ago, 20? I mean, and how is it advancing?
Well, I think the coaching is a lot better because you have a generation of coaches like Pooch Daese and Oakland Salaveo. His brother Joe is a pretty prominent coach in the Northwest at, I think, Washington or Oregon State. The coaching's better. But the facilities are still laughable by mainland standards. What's also apparent is that because of technology and the fact that folks like June Jones and Polamalu and even Jim Harbaugh wanted to go there and do one of his satellite camps, that and the fact that coaches can look at film of these kids through Huddle and other things on the web has brought more attention to them. A lot of them will get taken off the island early and transfer to a high school in the United States where they're going to get better coaching and more attention and be more accessible to recruiters. So it's gotten a lot better, but there's a ways to go.
So when that happens, when they are younger, they're not out of high school and that, do the families move there, or do they just let the kids go there and try to develop?
You know, sometimes families will move there, but Samoan families are not nuclear. You belong to an extended family called an Ainga, which has its own group of elected leaders, and those Aingas extend around the world. So almost every person I ever met and spoke with about their family at one point or another had other people who were not from the father and mother living with them and vice versa. So Troy Polamalu, for example, leaves Southern California and grows up in 10 Mile, Oregon with his uncle Salu, who just died last week. Troy's uncles, Kennedy, who coached and helped recruit him to USC, and is recruiting, I believe, coaching with Minnesota now. His brother, Al, who was on a championship Penn State team. Everybody can circulate. So it's not hard. If you want to send your son to Hawaii or California, you've probably got family in that extended family there for them to move in with and take care of. And that's just a very comfortable aspect of Samoan life.
So what's next now as this continues to evolve? And then maybe just kind of put in perspective, not because, again, they go over to the mainland and, get into high school and all that stuff. But it's like on a yearly basis, I mean, how many real good football players get integrated into the U.S. and then eventually into college and then maybe eventually into the NFL?
Well, start with the reality that there are probably fewer than 250,000 Samoans who live in either the U.S. territory or the United States. About 70,000 in the territory, the rest in Hawaii, California, Utah, and a few other places. So we're talking about a tiny number. And yet, they are probably about 38 times as likely on a per capita basis to make it to the NFL as the average population. And I think last year some 50-plus Samoans played in the NFL, a couple of hundred in Division I football. There are also probably 20 to 30 people of Tongan descent who grew up in the United States, primarily Hawaii and Utah. Those numbers, I think, will edge up. And the prominence of Samoans will become more apparent because of the crisis in American football, where more and more families from better-off circumstances are hoping their kids don't play football. And the numbers of youth in high school football have been dropping. I think also what we're seeing is that Samoans are escaping the typecasting that they're only good for playing positions on the line. I think Marcus Mariota, Tua Tagovailoa, and other players, Juju Smith-Schuster, are showing that what we call the skilled positions, they're quite good at too. So I think you're going to see more prominence in that regard. I also think, I'm hoping that more resources will be invested, particularly in the territory, to make Samoan football safer. They don't do the baseline concussion impact test before each season. They play with helmets that they shouldn't play with, and they probably hit way too much. I think if you don't do that, there's a looming public health disaster that's going to just amplify what we now know about concussions in American football.
The book is Tropic of Football, The Long and Perilous Journey of Samoans to the NFL. Rob Rook wrote the book. Great job. And where can everybody get it?
Well, the New Press is its publisher. I suspect most people, because I can hardly find a bookstore these days, get it online. Uh-huh. And I think if you just Google it, you'll find that Amazon and a lot of other booksellers will get it to you pretty quickly.
Rob, thank you so much for joining us on Schooled with a Professor.
Thanks so much, John. Be well.
And that does it for this week's podcast. In between episodes, you can follow me on Twitter @ClaytonESPN. If you enjoy these weekly one-on-one conversations, consider leaving a review on iTunes or wherever you're listening to the show. Thanks for listening. See you next time on Schooled with a Professor.